Hey friends, we have a new sponsor today, and I want to make sure that you support them because they make Hansel Minutes possible. RavenDB. It's a document database that's non-relational and fully transactional. It's available for Windows and Linux with official client APIs for .NET, the JVM, Go, Ruby, Node.js, and Python. RavenDB is designed for high performance, handling tens of thousands of requests even on a single node. Now, RavenDB is capable of on-the-fly optimization, dynamic indexes, and much more. It has a fully loaded GUI, which means it's simpler to operate, and you don't need, you know, arcane incantations on the command line. It just works. It's fast, and it's right. Download your free community edition at ravendb.net. That's RavenDB.net. I hope you check it out. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with VM Brasseur. She is the Vice President of the Open Source Initiative, and she's got 20 years in the business of software and 30 years with free and open source software, and is currently an open source policy and strategy freelancer who just wrote a fantastic book called Forge Your Future with Open Source that I was very happy to do a little quote about, a little blurb to hopefully support your book. Thanks for chatting with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. And thank you so much for the blurb. I do appreciate that it takes a fair bit of time to do those sorts of things.
Well, it's also nice for me because I get to read a book because the publisher will email you and say, hey, this great book is coming out. And, you know, this happens a lot where someone says there's a great book coming out. And we all say, yeah, sure there is. Right. But they'll give you a PDF of it and you go, there's a topic. And the next thing you know, I've read the book. It's funny how those things work. So I'm thrilled to have gotten a free book, and I will now have to, when it comes out, I'll go and buy a copy as well. I don't feel like there's a book that is as clear and concise and as prescriptive as your book when it comes to open source as it relates to one's future, one's own career.
That's because there isn't a book about this at all. This is, as far as we can tell, and we've done some pretty extensive searches now, and I obviously would have known about it professionally. This is the first and only book on how to contribute to free and open source software. And it was very important for me for it not just to be the mechanics, because let's face it, you can read a document and learn how mechanically to contribute to a free and open source software project. But why do you want to do that? And how do you do it in a way that best benefits you and your career and the entire community all at the same time? It's very important that we cover all of those because you got to get something out of this beyond just warm fuzzies.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you use the word the mechanics of it because, like you said, there are certainly like, here's how you do a pull request. You know, that's been written 1,000 times. And I recently had April Wenzel on the show and we talked about what is sometimes called soft skills or squishy skills. And she said, well, that's not a good way to phrase it. Those are not terms that we should use. There's the practical realities of how to interact with the community. There's no reason to call it soft. It's certainly as hard as anything, interacting with community.
Well, what I found is that the technical stuff is actually the easiest part. Hmm. Because the technical stuff doesn't really come from quite as entrenched a place of culture and history and background and personalities. I mean, obviously, that's reflected in the technical part in any community. But it's the people side of things that's very, very difficult. I can't, like, drop a Docker file into a team and have it instantly, you know, perform like the team I had on my other department. It doesn't work that way. People are different. And so you have to learn how to interact with the people. And that's very complicated.
Are open source communities and open source people any different than any other thing, like a committee to do something around your neighborhood? Or like, sometimes it feels like it's just harder. Is it because we're all engineers and we all like our things to compile and humans just don't?
Well, humans definitely don't compile. Every group is going to be different. So to that extent, the answer is going to be yes. Each free and open source community will be its own special thing that will approach things differently from another free and open source community. But on the other hand, They are all composed of people. Hmm. And because of that, you have to respect the humanity of each individual. So regardless of whether you're working with your PTA group, whether you're working with, say, a karate class, or whether you're working with free and open source software, you have to respect the individuality of each of those people and learn to work with them on their terms. But they obviously should be doing the same thing in the other direction for all of the other community members. That doesn't always happen, obviously, because, you know, we're people and things are difficult. But that's the best case situation.
I like how practical this is. I'm looking at Chapter 7, which talks about, you know, you're giving a contribution and now what? And there's even a section where you say, like, what to do while you wait. You've done your PR, and I've seen people do a pull request, and then, like, every hour, I like, did you check it? Have you looked at my pull request? Have you reviewed this? Can we get this done? Like, what do you do? Maybe your contribution isn't accepted. It's very realistic, this book.
Well, I think one of the things that not just free and open source software, but humans in general, but I'll just scope it down to technologists, we're very bad at setting up expectations. And because of that, we set up technological methods around that. So we don't have to set up expectations. You can just go out of your way yourself to go check over here for status. You go check on status. We're not going to tell you when it might change. So setting up expectations for people in advance and saying, well, yes, it might be declined, and here are some reasons why. Yes, it might take a while, and here are some reasons why, will really help to, I think, diminish some of the anxiety that people can have from being a first-time contributor. And just we're really excited when we contribute. And landing your first patch feels so good. Mm-hmm. So if we can get people to understand that, yeah, you will land your first patch, but it might take a little while. So be patient. And here's why it will take a little while. I think that can help keep some of the excitement up. And we really would love to maintain that momentum of positive emotion when contributing to and accepting open source contributions.
Yeah. There's a whole section about when you're participating in discussions, you call out that in the free and open source software contribution process, communication is where the unwritten rules hide, right? There's no document. There's documents that tell you how your pull request should be formatted, but there isn't one that says how you should interact with the community and the fact that those habits and those expectations vary from community to community.
Yeah, the expectations will vary. And that's why it's always important when you are contributing to read the contributor guide. It's there for a reason. Please don't just go your own way. So read the contributor guide, listen on whatever chat rooms people have and see how they interact. You know, lurk on the chat rooms, lurk on the mailing list and see how people interact to try to understand the cultural mores of that particular community. Because otherwise, you might just go in there like a bull in a china shop, expecting that the way you were interacting in one community will work the same at another community. And there is not a direct mapping there. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. And you call out important things that I think once you've said them, I think are obvious, but they need to be said. Like you say, comprehend, then act rather than react. It seems like on the internet, there's so many people who are waiting for their turn to speak, which is different than listening.
Yeah, for whatever psychological reasons, which will be individual, but as a culture, we seem to be very reactionary right now. We want to be heard, and there's a lot of value in wanting to be heard and particularly in being heard itself. But there's even more value in listening and understanding what people are looking for, what people would like to hear, how you can interact with them in a way that will benefit both you in trying to land your patch, but also the community. Because again, bull in a china shop might be fun for the bull, but not for anyone else.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to me that we're contributing source code, which is text, which compiles and does exactly what it's supposed to if we wrote it correctly. But then we choose to communicate in text, which is, like, of all the communication mediums, the one that offers the least context. It's like the great equalizer. but I can't see your tone. I can't see your subtle face movements to tell if you're joking or not. I mean, sarcasm and text don't often go side by side. What a challenge to communicate both with code and with prose, but text is maybe not the right one for the communication part.
It can be very difficult, which is why I do mention that sometimes you have to get together. Mm. Sometimes you have to be in the same place. Sometimes you just everyone hop on Skype or Google Hangouts or something, just so you can get slightly more high definition communication. But it's also worth noting that code isn't the only way to contribute. And this book is not purely for programmers. It has some examples that use code contributions, but it also has examples using documentation and marketing and there are lots of different ways to contribute to free and open source software. So if you don't feel like you are a strong programmer yet, it's okay. We need you anyway.
I really appreciate that you said that. And I appreciate that there's, in fact, an entire chapter on making a difference without making a pull request, because people seem to think that it's all about, you know, the most complicated change you could make or the most sophisticated code. But designers and documentation and community building, all of these things have huge value, particularly documentation.
Documentation is that force multiplier of any software, but particularly free and open source software projects. You know, I can keep this information in my head, but I don't scale. Whereas a well-formatted piece of documentation does scale. Now, documentation is slightly problematic because a lot of people suggest it as your first free and open source software contribution. And for some people, that could be good. And if the contribution is very small, say a typo or something like that, that can be good. But the problem with documentation is to make it good, to make it effective for the end user, you have to know a lot about the project itself. So often, documentation is not the best place for you to start unless you are already familiar with the project because you use it at work or you use it in your own private hobbies or something like that. But documentation is not always going to be the best place for everyone to start when contributing to free and open source software.
You call out a couple of places for starting for new programmers that I didn't see coming. For example, you had a comment, you have a section here rather about code reviews where you say that, and I love this, you don't have to be a rockstar ninja 10x unicorn diva programmer with years of experience to have valuable insights. And I never thought about that. I would assume that the code reviewers should be the most experienced people, but it's not always the case.
It's not always the case. I mean, for the very complicated issues or for the more nuanced issues of we didn't do it that way over in that module, so we have to do it in this module. You know, those obviously require a great deal of experience with the code base and with the project. But just anyone can look at a piece of code and go, huh, these don't line up properly. Or, huh, I'm a new programmer and I can't figure out what you're doing here. If a new programmer can't understand what's happening in a method, it's probably too complicated. So asking questions is a great way to provide feedback because something that somebody does not understand is not very maintainable. Yeah. So you can learn a great deal about the project, about programming, even if you don't know a lot about programming, just by reviewing the contributions. Now, obviously, you won't be able to merge them because you don't have the access for that. But your comments still have value. But don't do it if the project doesn't want you to do it. There are some projects such as OpenStack, for instance. One of the first things new contributors would do would be to review issues as they come in and to review patches. And that was encouraged. But it's not encouraged in all projects. So check before you do it.
Mm-hmm. And we talk about testing and we talk about docs, but you also call out testing the docs, which is another great opportunity for someone to come in as a new developer to come in with fresh eyes and see if they can get started.
So this is something I would encourage with all of my new developers. Prior to going freelance, I led software engineering departments at the director and VP level. And when I would have new people come in as part of their onboarding, if you find anything wrong with the documentation, let us know. And or if the processes were there to support that, fix it. you know, make it better for the people going forward, because it's only with really fresh eyes that you can see whether the documentation is effective. So if you're setting up your new developer environment and the docs don't mention that you require a certain dependency, that's really valuable information. And if you find that and update the docs or open an issue for it, you will have saved several people many hours of work when they hit that problem. So you yourself become a force multiplier and saving other people's time just by fixing a document.
And that idea that you're saving people time, that you're helping other people, that empathy that one develops, whether it be testing or reading docs, it all comes down to the reminder that it's humans behind all of this. We did make this software for people to use and for people to experience.
Empathy is it's becoming a buzzword lately, which is A, great, but B, I'm afraid people might get too used to it and start glossing over it. So empathy is very important in everything we do, in your day-to-day life, in your professional life, and in contributing to free and open source software. So being aware of the circumstances that other people might be going through, actually using open source as well. So if you need a fix, and if you currently aren't at a place where you're able to make that fix, and so you open a bug about it, don't go bashing on the poor maintainer because they don't get back to you in a day, a week, a month. They have lives. They're trying to do their own thing. They're trying to raise a family to, you know, get through university. You know, so being aware of the fact that other people are involved and that they have complicated issues just like you have complicated issues, and being sensitive to that is very important for really accomplishing what you want.
Yeah, it is tough. I hear what you're saying, that the word empathy, sometimes it gets used so much, you hit people over the head with it. But in all things, to just remember that you're a person in front of a keyboard talking to another person in front of a keyboard. So for example, you talk about triage issues and figuring out whether or not, you know, why isn't my pull request happening and why isn't this issue the number one issue? Because it might be crucially important to you, but you may also not have visibility into the release cycle of this particular project. We have issues on our project where people are mad and they don't understand that, like, well, we're not actually writing code right now. We're in the testing phase, or we're in a different part of the sprint and not ready for you.
Yeah, and that's why I do recommend, I mean, I would love it if project maintainers read this book as well, so they could get a better sense of what are the contributors even expecting. Because if they, you know what your contributors are expecting, then you can anticipate that a little better and maybe make the entire process more pleasant for everyone. But I do recommend that they publish some sort of roadmap and put that in their contributor guide and say, hey, please check this, because that can set up expectations within the contributor. Oh, wait, they can't look at my bug right now because of that, right?
A big thank you to our sponsors, because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at telerik.com/Hanselman. That's TELERIK.com/Hanselman. Pivoting a little bit to more of the career side, because this book really is about forging your future as well as helping the community. It's not just a book about how to contribute to open source. You point out that every project has tedious tasks that no one likes doing, whether it be data cleanup or things that are repetitive, things that could be scripted. And you point out that those are opportunities for someone to jump in and move their career forward. It's a good opportunity for someone who's new to a free and open source project.
Absolutely. I mean, we all want to do these things if we're a maintainer of a free and open source software project, but because we do have so many pulls on our time, we don't get the chance to follow through. So, you know, just changing a variable so it's standardized across the way, updating tests, updating documentation, reformatting the docs to be, say, from ASCII doc to Markdown. These are things that for one reason or another, a project might have on its roadmap, but it just doesn't get to do because it's a real pain in the butt. It's just a lot of tedious work. But if you jump in there and you start doing just little things here and there, mm-hmm. people will learn that you're reliable. They will learn that you care about the project. And you will learn a great deal about the project. So you will be able to level up within the project a lot more quickly. You'll be super helpful to the entire community, not just the project, but all the users. And you yourself will gain a lot out of it.
Mm-hmm. And that visibility, that idea that software is as much showing up as it is writing and contributing code, that visibility is going to help your career as well. People will know you. You are that person that continually shows up and tries to move the ball forward.
Yeah, it just showing up. Showing up is one of the biggest things. Being reliable, making promises and following through on them. That's how you learn. That's how you earn trust, mm-hmm. right? Is by showing up and being reliable and following through on your promises. And then once you earn trust, people will start to trust you with larger projects or with leading teams, with leading features. Mm-hmm. But you have to earn the trust before you get to that stage. You can't just jump in. No matter how great of a programmer you are, you still have to earn the trust of the community.
Mm-hmm. And you actually show a hierarchy kind of experience and responsibilities that you represent multiple times in the book as an onion, so a series of concentric circles with users on the outside and then moving inward into smaller circles. Users, new contributors, contributors, core contributors, or then founders and leadership. And you really, you can't leapfrog any of those steps.
You really can't. And I forget exactly which academic came up with the onion model. Mm-hmm. Their work is referenced in the book, but I don't keep it off the top of my head. But what I do keep on the top of my head is thanking Sage Sharp of Outreachy. They and I had coffee several months ago, and they asked, hey, do you cover this in your book? And I was like, well, gosh, I don't. But that's just because it never occurred to me. It's just been so obvious to me that I wouldn't have thought to ask that. But they did, because they hear it all the time from all of their mentors and mentees in the Outreachy program. They don't know that there's a hierarchy. They don't know that, well, not in all projects, but almost every project has a hierarchy. So I was really grateful to them for suggesting that I include that in the book. Thank you, Sage.
Yeah, absolutely. Sage has been very thoughtful in giving me feedback on how interactions with the community can be made better. And the academics that you're referring to are Walt Scotchy and Wai Yi and Kei Kishida, and you reference that. And there's a lot of actually really good references. Even beyond the book, you've done your homework, and you've got the footnotes and endnotes to the point where I can go off and find other resources to learn about.
Well, I'm glad you like that, because footnotes are not really part of the standard style guide for my publisher.
Yeah, but there's a bibliography with, like, you go through a review of general psychology. Like, there's psychology behind being successful in open source.
Absolutely, because there's psychology around being successful in life, in work, in just about anything you accomplish. Really studying some basic psychology and group dynamics can help you a great deal in your career, and it does work just as well in free and open source software.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about the difference between free and open source software, or FOSS, and OSS, and a little bit about licensing.
Licensing, yes. So the very first thing most people consider when we talk about free and open source software is licensing. And frankly, I believe it's the very last thing we should consider. And I do make sure that there is a chapter in the book on how to release your open source project, because a lot of people just don't know. Really, there's a better book on that by Carl Fogel, and that is referenced in my book. But it was not proper for me not to even address it. And the very last thing I cover is licensing, because there are so many other things you have to get right. Frankly, the license usually does not impact the success of your free and open source project. Everything before that, the documentation, the contributor guide, the code of conduct, you know, all of that matters. But the license pick one that's OSI approved and meets your specific case, you know, and you're fine.
That's a great point. I've actually had an interesting situation happen recently with a license where a large company with a name that everyone would recognize copied a bunch of code from a smaller company of two or three people that was built on top of some open source software. You know how people built consultancies on top of their open source software. And if you look at the commits, it's basically a copy paste, a rename of a bunch of namespace, and the removal of a copyright. And we thought it was going to be a lot of what we call mustache twirling, like there was an evil villain in the background somewhere. But it turned out it was just someone who was not really educated. And even though it might look malicious, it was just a matter of you know, for lack of a better word, junior engineer is learning the process. But it was really difficult to have the community not see evil versus seeing misunderstanding.
Yeah, the first thing you should always do in any sort of situation where you feel some sort of affront is to always assume ignorance, not malice. You know, start with ignorance, particularly where copyright and intellectual property law is concerned. I mean, I am not a lawyer. I'll just get that out there right now. But I have spent a lot of time around lawyers, intellectual property lawyers, but also free and open source software. And what you have to remember is that copyright is so important. It's if you mess with copyright at all, you are very likely to get yourself into a world of legal hurt that will cost you endless hours, months, days, years of your life, and more money than you care to consider. So think about copyright before you go changing it. And I respect the want, the desire to, quote, clean up the code, but you can't do that. Because that copyright shows who owns, well, that copyright statement shows who owns the copyright over that particular piece of software. If you develop software, you instantly have copyright over it in the vast majority of countries in the world. Anything that, any country that is a signatory to what is called the Berne Convention, they all do copyright pretty much the same. So it's very important not to mess with it. And I talk about copyright and intellectual property law several times throughout the book because it is important that you understand the basics. You don't have to be a lawyer, but you have to understand the basics of copyright, of licensing, and of not messing with that sort of stuff because it'll get you in a lot of trouble. And even worse, it'll get your company in trouble and then you get fired. That's not good for your future.
And speaking of your company, you have a whole chapter as well on contributing to open source software while you are employed. So looking at your employment agreement, what are your company's policies? Does your employer support free and open source software? Do they have their own software? What about moonlighting and all of those things, the potential pitfalls that you could bump into if you decided to be an open source person and perhaps not working for an open source company?
Yeah, that one gets pretty complicated because if you're working for a company, the work you do, that copyright belongs to your company.
Oh, right. If you're working on their machine, on their network, and you're sitting in their chair on their time, you made it for them.
You made it for them. And there are some companies where your employment agreement will say that even if you're not on company time, if you're on your own time, it doesn't matter. We own your stuff.
Wow.
If you're on your own time and on your own computer, okay, that's yours. But if you're doing it on our computer, then it's our stuff. So there's various permutations of this. And it's important to be aware of that before you just casually toss off a contribution to a free and open source software project, that there are plenty of situations where you don't have the right to give that contribution to a project because it belongs to your company and you have to get their approval. So thinking about that in advance will save you so many headaches.
Yeah, we ended up encouraging this particular company and this young developer to bring the binary in and use the library as a binary rather than trying to bring the source in. And, you know, ultimately the crisis was averted, but it would have been nice to have a book like this to share with the young people and make it a part of the larger company's open source education process.
Yeah, that would be very nice just to get people a little more aware of it. I mean, in a perfect world, I can wish for companies to educate their employees on basic matters of copyright and intellectual property. But, you know, in a perfect world, I can also ask for a pony, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get it.
Indeed. The last thing I wanted to say that I really appreciated about the book is that you actually have an appendix that's not called glossary. You called it jargon. And you put in all the jargon that one drops, and it's pages and pages and pages. When people throw things out, phrases that someone might not understand, you made sure that we all understood that, and that was really cool.
If you've ever done any traveling, even just to the other side of the country, your own country, you'll find lots of terms that people are using and you don't understand it. Like you go to Pennsylvania, and what even is a Scrapple? You know, there's lots of things like that, and it's very uncomfortable. So learning the language of the new environment you are going to participate in is one of the best ways for you to feel comfortable. And then you will perform better, and you will give much better contributions. And people will like you better because you're speaking their language.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book is called Forge Your Future with Open Source, and it's under the Pragmatic Programmers imprint. And folks can go up to the Pragmatic Programmers and purchase that, right?
Yes, it's available in early release beta right now. It's available in print in mid-October. We're going through all the pre-publication sort of hoops right now. But if you order it now in early release beta, then when it does come out in print, you get an email saying, hey, would you like to buy the print copy at a significant discount? So I do encourage you to go out and get it. And there's an errata section in the book where if you find any bugs, you know, this is free and open source software. Please let me know what to fix and that we can work on it in the next version.
Very cool. Well, congratulations to you, and thank you for letting me read your book. And I hope that the folks that are listening will check it out. I will include a link in the show notes so you can pick that up, and you can connect with VM on Twitter. I'll put a link there as well. Thanks so much for chatting with me.
This has been great. Thanks so much for taking the time.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.